11 that we can...
Let's start. We're going to resume our debate, the topic dynamic risk management. Give the floor to Ross.
Thank you very much. In today's sessions, we will discuss two papers, Agenda Paper 4B, Derivative Used for DRM Purposes, and Agenda Paper 4C, Financial Performance. Agenda Paper 4A has been provided using the tentative decisions to date, but we do not plan on discussing this paper any further. The staff proposed the board discuss Paper 4B first, and that will conclude the discussions on the scope of the DRM model, and then we will discuss Paper 4C to begin our deliberations on performance, i.e., the information to be provided in the statement of profit or loss. No concerns there? Okay, great. So agenda paper in paper 4B, the staff proposed that interest rate swaps, including basis swaps, forward starting swaps, and forward rate agreements, otherwise known as FRAs, should be addressed in the first phase of the model for primarily two reasons. Firstly, these types of instruments capture a large majority of the derivative markets, as evidenced by the BIS survey referenced in the paper. And secondly, they are all commonly used and very effective at managing interest rate risk. The staff would specifically highlight that the model will accommodate basis swaps given they are highly effective instruments in the context of transformation. The staff are proposing that options, such as a swaption, be considered in the second phase and to seek feedback on their overall importance within the DRM model during outreach. The staff are also proposing that only contracts external to the reporting entity be eligible within the DRM model for the reasons listed in paragraphs 22 through 26. Finally, the staff are proposing that formal designation and documentation of derivatives is required and that voluntary de-designation, absent a change in the risk management strategy, should be prohibited, as discussed in paragraphs 28 through 32. With that, I would ask the board to vote on the questions in paper 4B. Firstly, does the board agree that interest rate swaps, including basis swaps, forward starting swaps, and FRAs, should be addressed in the first phase of the model, while interest rate options should be considered during outreach?
Looking for discussion. Darrell?
I think it's fairly obvious in the way you set this up and in the way it's written, but I just want to make sure that I'm...
Set this up.
I think it's a slight distinction between the way we're talking about it in this paper and possibly the way we're talking about it in the next paper. So in this paper, you're asking us questions about the model that we are going to take out on the road and outreach on. And that means that we are creating, if you like, a temporary fence around what that model is going to look like. In the next paper, when we talk about it, we're actually talking about the first of a couple of steps that will be part of phase one.
Yes.
Okay, so I just wanted to check that. Thank you.
So, I agree with your preliminary view on the range of derivatives, but in paragraph 21, we say the staff will seek external feedback on whether options should be addressed in the second phase of the project. I think we just need to be careful when we ask that question that we understand, because I think sometimes people just think of all of the different permutations that it might be nice to consider, and we don't want to go become too complicated. So if people say that it should be covered, I think it'll be good to understand why they think it needs to be covered and how important it is, so we can assess the sort of cost benefit of the potential complexity.
I think this will be important because, as we also point out in the paper, that as soon as we get into options, the complexity goes up significantly, and also the way we have set up the bucketing doesn't work the way we have proposed, because that's not meant for options. And normally, other than in few exceptional circumstances, the market for swaptions, which are used, is very limited. It's not there outside the US very much. So we will caveat it, saying that if it is going to be included, we need to understand how much we are going to cover extra for this. And that's why in this phase, we are saying this is not critical enough.
Okay. Can we support staff's recommendation?
Sir.
Oh.
And
maybe. I'll ask it to follow up.
Yeah. Okay. All in favor?
Yep.
Sorry, the follow-up was that you phrased it as whether it should be addressed. I think we've got to be clear as we move forward, particularly out of phase one into phase two, is whether it's only, you know, it's permitted. It's only permitted if it's explicit, or if it's silent with respect to some things, and you have to make up your mind. So when you say it should be addressed, I think what you mean is whether it should be a permitted, and you can only qualify presumably if it's permitted.
Absolutely,
okay.
Not by silence. Fair point, Matt. Not by silence.
Okay. Secondly, does the board agree that only contracts external to the reporting entity be eligible with the DRM model for the reasons listed in paragraphs 22 through 26?
Errol?
So on the same basis as my previous question, sort of confirm that now this is not about phase one, phase two. This is about ever.
It's about ever.
Just a quick comment. I do agree with staff. I would just... The question is not really to base a decision like ours in recommendations like the one in 26 from the Basel Committee. I think it's an additional layer of information, but not really to base our decision on the accounting model.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, it's just an additional data point.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Because in the question...
What if they change it? Doesn't mean we go and change ours.
Yeah, we put... 26 as a reference to our support.
Yeah, exactly.
Martin. Only one question, man. Is that okay? These derivatives have to be determined especially, and also only external ones. Does it mean that from the beginning of these derivatives, there has to be assigned to hedge accounting, or could it also be that a bank, for example, using trading derivatives and then assigning them for hedging afterwards?
They could get assigned subsequently.
Current practice is already.
Just start with a non-zero pivot.
Yeah.
It'll start with a non-zero, but that's the current practice. You can put it. It means it doesn't have to be from day one you have to put it there. You might have a portfolio of derivatives. I won't use the word portfolio because we have we have a block of derivatives. You put it in.
Agree with the staff's recommendation?
All in favour?
Finally, does the board agree that formal designation and documentation of derivatives is required and that voluntary de-designation absent a change in the risk management strategy should be prohibited as discussed in paragraphs 28 through 32?
Question. Gary?
Just sort of an operational question on it, because I actually agree with the recommendations. In fact, in all of hedge accounting, the only common theme is designation. In this case, it's you're designating a portfolio as opposed to an individual instrument. On question 34, this bothered me in former lives. You say it's prohibited to voluntarily de-designate a derivative. I mean, this is a compliance problem, from importantly for governance. What happens if you do? Do you unwind the accounting and pretend you didn't de-designate it? Do you not comply with IFRS? Do you tank the whole portfolio? But, what happens? I mean, because you say you can't do it and say, okay, well, I did. Now what? And do we have to answer that question, now what, in the standard? Or is it more of a regulator issue? What happens?
I think we will cover that in the paper, in the discontinuation of the model. So you will have to discontinue.
But they're not allowed to.
But you're saying you can't discontinue it here.
You cannot voluntarily de-designate. The only thing which you can do is that due to the risk management strategies, get out. Mm-hmm. If it's a change in strategy. Otherwise, if it's in the model, it's in the model there.
But this is the circumstance in which you still have the underlying items, you still have the derivative, you still have... Clearly, you can get out of this by selling the derivative. But that's a different condition.
But
I think the answer to Gary's question, as I understand it, would be, assuming you still have the hedged item, and I'm calling them hedged items, the thing you're hedging and the derivative instrument.
And the risk management strategy.
And your risk management objective has stayed the same, you'd be required to keep posting the entries, I think.
Yeah, so you're in.
Yeah.
You're in.
Runs its course.
Yep.
Okay. I'm just curious.
Mary?
Ross, I wondered if you could just recap for me the distinction that you're trying to make in this section about portfolio versus group of derivatives, because it seems to be saying you don't designate portfolio derivatives at a portfolio level, but you can, if you want, designate them at the group level. And I think from something you said to me before that you were saying it's forbidden to do it at the portfolio label. You're just saying it's not necessary. But if you could just color that in a bit more, that would be helpful for me.
And perhaps we could have been better on wording here, but when we've used portfolio almost as a defined term when we've talked about the asset and target profiles, and so portfolios have to share similar risk characteristics. So then if I port that language to derivatives, given with how we've stated kind of this phase one derivative construction, all those derivatives share similar risk characteristics. And so the kind of the concept of a portfolio wouldn't really get into any, I would say, meaningful aggregation. So we wanted to stay away from that word. But if someone is able to group them together and then designate that group, then as long as you can still do the performance and the reclassification that we described, I don't mind if you designate them together or if you do individual designations. You can group them if you would like. If that's better for you, fine. But you still have to do all the performance information there.
So it's kind of that the criteria for designating a portfolio are automatically met by the limited population that we're considering in phase one. But that means that when we do phase two, if we decide we want to expand the population, we might have to go back on that portfolio point if any of the things that we then say also could be used as, I'll call them hedging instruments, because they may not automatically have the same characteristics.
Possibly.
We don't know until we know what it is, if anything, we add in.
Possibly, but the rationale that we were thinking is kind of what I described.
Okay. No, it wasn't an objection. It was just I'm not sure I'm following all the implications.
Yep.
I thought we'd been using the term portfolio to talk more about the assets and liabilities as opposed to the derivatives.
Yes.
Yeah, which was a simpler answer than this. But my question was on this groups of derivatives as well. And my first question is, have we ever allowed in hedge accounting before to have groups of derivatives designated as the hedging instrument in a single hedging relationship?
Yes.
More than one.
We do allow this.
More than one. We have never spoken about a group or anything like that, but more than one. You can layer hedges, yes.
You can combine hedges.
In one hedging relationship.
Yeah.
Okay. So it is possible to do the unwinds properly?
Yes.
Yes. Layering, that's why Ross, when he answered, as you said, we didn't want to use portfolio because we use it in a different context. It doesn't add anything. As long as the mechanics work, you can layer in and layer out instruments even in existing hedging relations today.
Mm-hmm.
And the mechanics will take care of the recycling. I'm not saying it'll be any simpler. You'll have to track more than one, but you can do that. And we don't need to change mechanics for that. So even in 9, we have layered hedging. So you have... You change the hedged item with another instrument, then you hedge that resulting cash flows.
But I thought that was one hedge and then another hedge on top of the first hedge. So it was specifically sort of one hedge, one or abridged items with one derivative.
Yeah.
Then I could hedge the outcome of those two things, which to me is different than saying I've got a group of things I'm hedging and a group of derivatives that I'm hedging that group of things with.
But even in a single hedge, and come in, today we can layer two derivatives. I can't use a derivative in the hedged item before, I couldn't. But now I can also bring it. But yes, we can do that. We layer it.
The most simple example is if you had a hedged item with a currency value of 100 and you had two derivatives each of 50, you can combine the derivatives together and designate. Or you could do it as two separate designations, but it's permitted today.
I'm still, thinking in my head, having trouble thinking about the
recycling.
Complexity of all of the assets and liabilities coming in and out with all of these layers of derivatives and how it's all going to get tracked and measured in some sort of responsible manner.
Response.
John Wu.
Thank you. Just a clarification on this paragraph 29, the last sentence.
Sorry, which one, Chung Wu?
29 paragraph, the last sentence. We are allowing the designation of group of derivatives just to reduce the amount of documentation required But that means the kind of a hedging relationship is maintained by individual derivative? No. So the, a group of derivatives have a kind of a dynamic hedging relationship. But this sentence is saying just a kind of a, some efficiency of documentation, so we are allowing the group of derivatives. So it's a kind of a confused economic relationship, while the kind of hedging relationship can be allowed as a group level.
I mean, I think what we were trying to say with that sentence was, rather than requiring someone to have 10 pieces of paper to say these 10 derivatives are going in, you can write it down on one piece of paper. I think that's simply put, more simply put, I think that's where we were, that's where our head was at. I don't know if that answers your question.
Okay, let me ask.
All right. We agree with the staff's recommendation.
All in favor?
Okay.
Four. For agenda paper 4C, I'm going to start by providing a bit of the plan on how we'll discuss performance. What I would like to do is actually almost tee up the individual question and then discuss the questions, because the questions are kind of a bit stacked. So I think if we tee up the entire paper and then discuss it might be less efficient. So we'll do it a bit differently for 4C, and hope everyone's okay with that. But 4C begins the discussions on performance, and I say begin because we're going to require more than one paper and one meeting to have a full discussion on performance. I've listed the discussions I'm planning to have and their order in paragraph 7, but to summarize quickly, those are: we'll discuss performance in the context of perfect alignment, that's today. We'll discuss the implications of decisions to date in the context of the dynamic nature, so Sue's comment just a moment ago. We'll discuss then performance in the context of imperfect alignment, including a discussion on tolerances and on the lower of test. And then finally, we'll have a conversation on presentation and disclosure. Everyone's okay with that plan? I'll move forward to the first section of the paper, which is what should be the information provided in the statement of profit or loss. The paper begins by discussing what should be the information provided in the P&L, and paragraphs 8 through 19 discuss why the P&L should reflect the entity's target profile if they have achieved perfect alignment. To summarize the staff's view, reflecting the target profile, i.e. the stated objective for a given asset profile, in the statement of profit or loss will provide a representation of performance on a basis consistent with the outcome and intent of the entity's DRM activities. Said more plainly, if an entity's risk management strategy is to stabilize the net of interest income and expense, and they achieve that strategy, the model will reflect stability in the statement of profit or loss. In that way, the model will reflect performance on a basis more consistent with the risk management view. The staff think it will provide relevant information because it will provide users with information to assess future cash flows, in addition to providing better information regarding the efficiency and effectiveness of management stewardship over the entity's financial resources. Finally, in conjunction with the information provided on the statement of financial position and through disclosure, it will allow for a better comparison of entities who dynamically manage risk. For these reasons, the staff believe that the statement of profit or loss should reflect the target profile in the case of perfect alignment, and that deferral and reclassification to the statement of profit or loss are the mechanism by which the DRM model facilitates that faithful representation. As such, the first question to the board is, does the board agree that the statement of profit or loss should reflect the target profile in the case of perfect alignment, and that deferral and reclassification are the mechanism by which the DRM model facilitates a faithful representation?
Let's see if you say no.
As Martin pointed out, this is the basis of this project, but let me challenge. In the paragraph 18, you picked up the two companies. The one company achieved the target profile by using derivative, perfect alignment. And the other company achieved perfect alignment without using derivative.
So you are saying that those two companies should provide same information on the profit or loss statement?
Similar. Not same. Similar.
No, not same, but in terms of performance, it should be same.
Similar, yeah.
Similar, okay. So I'm not very much sure about it. So I think those two companies has a totally different, could be totally different risk profile. Because one company has a derivative, the other company do not have. So some investor may care about it. So some investor may want such differences to be reflected in the profit or loss statement. So that is the whole point of this project. So with the presumption that users and the constituents are happy with having a similar profit or loss statement. But the problem, I think the issue we have to address is the transparency. So it's not simple micro hedge, it's a macro hedge based on the risk management quality. So if the risk management quality is very good and very transparent, maybe a profit or loss statement should be similar. But if the quality of risk management is doubtful and not very much transparent, then that would cause some hypothetical problem because the derivative is not that simple in the real world. So therefore, if it could mask the fundamental differences, so it may raise some issues. So that is the point I wanted to make clear.
No, a very good point, Tuck. And let me just elaborate on a couple of things. We are talking about the performance.
Yeah.
It only works in conjunction with the statement of financial position, which we have spoken about in the paragraph before.
Uh-huh.
So the balance sheet, if you're using derivatives, is where you get the full idea of what your exposure, because I don't think they are the same.
Mm.
So it doesn't work in isolation. I think it works only in conjunction with what other information is provided in the statement of financial position, along with the derivatives on which decisions we have taken.
Yeah.
So it is not in isolation just the P&L should be the same. I absolutely agree regarding what you're saying is that it's a quality of risk management which should drive it, and we are not in that, but that's where it comes into the question. Is in case you are not perfectly aligned and your risk management isn't that great, what is the information content that will be provided through imperfect alignment? And that's the topic after, not this, we come to dynamic after this and then that. So that's the element that needs to be captured. Absolutely. As I was thinking, if nothing else, this project has given us quite a few quotable quotes, and one of them is from you, Portfolio of Lies. So we need to be careful.
Remember
that. A few other quotes which I will go. That's what it has given. So, yes, transparency, as Ross said in the thing, it's only in conjunction with all three that we can achieve this. And also, I think it's, in my view, a bit unrealistic to think that only one statement can give a complete picture of an activity as complex as this. It's impossible.
Thank you.
Mary?
Couple of comments on this section. One is, it's maybe related to Tuck's point, I'm not sure. Paragraph 13, make a sentence in the middle that, or towards the end, consequently, the risk management strategy to stabilize net income and expense is achieved when, blah, blah, blah. And this is one of my pet projects in this project is, it isn't the actual net income and expense that is stabilized, it's the combination of the three legs, the asset, the liability, and the derivative that transforms. And I think we might do ourselves some favors if we started talking about the effect of the package or the three legs or something, because it isn't literally the net interest and expense that's transformed, but it's looking at the three legs of it. So I'd like to express that because it keeps remembering that is, I think, important. I mean, we've said credit risk doesn't dominate. We have other characteristics that mean it shouldn't be important. But that is one of the differences in your example in paragraph 18 is, you know, in the perfectly matched entity has credit risk of its borrowers, and the entity that has the perfect risk strategy has credit risk of its counterparties as well as its borrowers. So, you know, it's a difference. And then the other thing is, and I think this is probably looking ahead to you guys having the fun of drafting a basis for conclusions, is the beginning about paragraph 17. It made the assertion that the information that would be provided by showing the P&L profile of the target, the P&L of the target profile, would be useful for future cash flows and assessment of stewardship. I don't disagree, but I don't think we've explained how it does both of those things, and I think we need to spell that out a bit more if we're going to make that kind of assertion. And I think you start to get to it at the end of paragraph 18, but I think if we're going to make assertions like that, we should explain how or why. And then the last is in the kind of the middle, well, taking this example of the two entities, one difference between them is the cost of the derivative that the first entity engages in, the second entity doesn't have. On the other hand, the second entity might spend a lot more to originate exactly the kind of loans it wants to match that, but that's additional relevant information about how they're the same and how they're different. So I think it isn't just about making their the margin look at, you know, report the same way, but to give the other aspects that show where they're like and where they're different. So it's not disagreement with your basic assertion that if you get perfection, that then what we should see in the P&L overall is the target profile P&L.
Yeah.
Thank you, Hans. I agree with Stav's proposal. Just a couple of questions or clarifications. First question, the DRM accounting model, whether this model will apply to financial institutions only or including other entities such as commodity entities?
Jinchao, as we have said from the very start of the project, this is only for interest rate risk, not for other risk.
But talking about the general accounting model.
No, it won't. It will only, if it's not entity specific, it's risk specific.
This is the only type of risk it would apply to.
All right, okay. Yeah, because
what we're exploring.
All right.
And okay. If this goes well and everything goes progresses, I don't know if I've even thought that far, then we will consider other risks, but not at the moment.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Because this is relevant to the paragraph, the last sentence of paragraph 4. Only this sentence will typically mention that financial institutions, but other, but yeah. And second question about whether all the changes of the fair value of designated derivative will go to OCI. Or just a portion of that?
Let's come to that. Well, I mean, we explain that in some detail later on in the paper.
We cover that in performance.
Mm. Yeah, but
later in the paper.
Later, yeah, I know. But actually, it's mentioned the first sections, but I would like to confirm that. Yeah.
If you're perfectly aligned,
yeah,
the whole change in fair value goes through OCI, and then it's recycled.
A portion is recycled.
Reclassified.
Okay.
And if you're not?
If not, so, yeah.
If you're not, what happens?
So, if not, steel portion could be, you know, recognized OCI. If not, steel portion of the perfect
aligned.
All those changes in fair value will go to OCI.
And a part will be reclassified into profit or loss immediately, to reflect the target profile, as we demonstrate in the second part of the paper.
Can I try on this? Because this is what I took a long time wrestling with, and why I was making the point about paragraph 13. It's the idea that you have the whole change in the fair value in the period, and then you say, you can either say, I put it all into OCI, and then I immediately take out the piece that represents the difference in the interest, income, and expense, or you could say, I pull out, you know, you're disaggregating the change in fair value into a piece that goes into the P&L in the current period as if it were interest, and a piece that goes into OCI. But that's, you know, that's what we're talking about in the assumption that it's perfect alignment. It's only those two pieces.
And it's exactly that. And it's standard cash flow hedge accounting mechanics. We are not proposing anything different.
Okay, yeah. I just want to confirm. Yeah.
We'll go through that in detail.
All right, okay. And the last one, I'm thinking about the term, the name of the term, the deferral and the reclassification. We're using the deferral, you know. Actually, those gain and loss already recognized and included, reflected in the financial statement. So people just simply look at the terms, think that we defer those gain and loss. So whether we can find
a better term,
we are not defer those gain and loss, but we simply just recognize those gain and loss in OCI. Yeah.
Okay.
François?
I think we're referring to perfect alignment in theory seems the logical things to do, thing to do. So I don't want to oppose to something that seems logical. At the same time, I think I'm not ready to make any decision today on this, so I think I'm going to abstain. Because I think I need to at least understand a fuller picture.
Mm.
You know, you have and I don't want to peek ahead to other issues that you have not teed up yet, but you refer to management strategies that would qualify, those that would not qualify. You refer to the extent of testing, so there are a number of issues that on which I can have a view today. But as long as I don't have an understanding of the effect in the income statement of this principle, I think I cannot subscribe to it. And I will have that understanding when I see what happens with misalignment.
So,
because I think we've said that the objective is to reflect the effect of the risk management strategy on the income statement. And I don't think that perfection exists. And so I'm really looking after... And on top of it, when you say refer to the comparison between the bunch of derivatives that I have and the comparison with the perfect derivatives, I don't even know to what extent this would be operationally feasible, what it would entail to identify these perfect derivatives and compare them to whatever I have. So, I may be in agreement, but I don't know yet.
Agreed.
And I may not be.
Yeah, I'm not asking you to be. I'm asking you to vote, give your vote. François, the idea of this is whatever we do, even in normal hedging, I need to send up a basis for which I compare things to. So if I say what is imperfection compared to what, I've got to set a baseline based on which I start comparing. And this is what it does. It sets the baseline from which we will start discussing. If you're away from the baseline, what happens? This just sets out the methodology on how to make that comparison, because otherwise I cannot even define what is imperfection. And in this case, I also have to measure it. So without setting this baseline, I can never go to imperfection. Alignment, that's not going to be possible. Anything when I'm looking at what is a difference, it's a difference between two points. Otherwise, we can't create a measure or a difference. And all we are trying to do is what is the setting the measure of how what we compare it from. We know imperfect, you will never be perfectly aligned. So that's why we talk about ratios, tolerances, lower of test. All of these come in. And nor have we said that all of these imperfections or misalignments or whatever we want to call it should immediately result in P&L. We are not there. It's what we measured it against. So it's a measure, and it's mathematically impossible to define it without setting one side. And that's what this one is doing.
So,
I think my observations are similar to Francois's. I'm not sure that I would go so far as to abstain, but I think I would say that it's hard to disagree that if you have the perfect situation, that this is the way that it should unfold in terms of performance reporting, given the build-up we've had to the sort of crescendo of this moment. But it all depends on what you think is perfect, and it also depends on what happens if it's not perfect. And so I think that's sort of what Francoise is saying, and I would agree with that. So can't disagree with if it's perfect, this is how it should unfold. So I think that's fine. But I guess a few observations and sort of thinking back to some of the experiences we've had in IFRS 9 hedge accounting in the past so that we don't stumble over the same things we've had in history. So, and I can understand why you want to use perfect the way that you are, because unlike the situation that we have in normal hedge accounting, where we measure perfection, if you like, by comparing the changes in value of our hedged item with the derivative we've got, here that's harder to do because you've got all of this volatility and dynamism and blah, blah, blah. So you want to do that comparison by comparing what would be perfect with what you've got.
Yep.
But I think that means this is subtly different to what we've used in, say, hedge accounting at the moment, because we don't have this notion really of the perfect thing you compare it with, because you compare it with the real thing. And I understand why you have to do that, but I think it comes with its own sets of complications. And I think what's really going to matter is going to be what happens if it's not perfect, and then what profile, what's your target, like your anchor, if you like, for your outcome you're heading for in P&L when you're imperfect. And I know that's for another day, but that's what's going to be coming. But to go back to sort of stumbles we've had along the way in the past on similar, but I know not identical, when I think we went out with our first ED on hedge accounting for IFRS 9, we had something not dissimilar to this, where we talked about the fact that hedging relationships should, and I can't remember the exact words, but it was something like minimise ineffectiveness. And that to us sounded like a very innocent comment and a sort of sensible thing to have as the objective to get into hedge accounting. But the feedback we got from preparers at the time was, what if it's not the perfect hedging instrument? Because it's not, you know. I would minimise ineffectiveness if I had this very particular derivative that had these very exact characteristics, that had exactly this notional, that had exactly these reset dates, blah, blah, blah. But for all sorts of good reasons, because of volume, because of cost or whatever, I might choose a derivative which does most of the job, but it's not the perfect derivative. Does that mean that because it's not perfect, that suddenly, you know, disaster strikes? Now, I know it's not as extreme here, because you're not saying you can't apply this model, or at least not yet. But you can't apply this model if it's not a perfect hedge. But I am a little bit worried in the back of my mind that people are going to say, well, you say that this is what I do when I'm perfect, but I don't think I'm ever necessarily going to be perfect the way that you think about perfect, and what's the consequence of that. So I think the word perfect, that's a very long way of saying. I think we need to be careful about the word perfect apart from anything else, because I think people are suspicious that we mean something much more definitive than we actually do when we use words like that. So I think we're going to get into questions very quickly about, you know, if I'm hedging a notional loan of 52 and I have to use a swap with 50, yeah, is that good enough, and all that sort of stuff. But can I just check one just general thing? So a couple of people have made the point that one of the differences between somebody who's just got the natural hedged position and the person who's had to use derivatives is that you've got another layer of credit risk exposure because you've entered into derivative transactions. And we're saying that it can't dominate, but you're still not going to be risk-free, so there will be credit risk. So just applying the normal mechanics, if there were changes in the credit risk of your counterparty that were affecting the fair value of your derivative, that would be recognised in the carrying amount of the derivative, but that, in a sense, would be sitting in OCI and moving around in OCI, and if they paid out in the end, that would sort of pull to par. But it would be on the balance sheet.
Absolutely.
It just wouldn't be in the P&L. Yeah. Yeah. So it would be available information, yeah, and then
absolutely.
We can think about presentation.
Absolutely. Absolutely available.
That's coming back to Chuck's point, Sue, and saying it's only in conjunction that we give the full picture, not in isolation.
But I do agree with Francoise that a lot of this depends on the what if it's not.
Absolutely, I'm not disagreeing. There are two things. We are focusing on what it is not, and we can think about that. That's one bit, and the other bit is the operational simplifications that we need to make this workable. But both of these can only be discussed if I put a benchmark against which I'm measuring, because it has to be measured. And for that, I need to find out what is the perfect and what is the ideal situation I'm trying to go for. Not does it, am I saying that this will be something that will automatically come to PNL or anything like that. That's a debate to be had.
But the challenge I think we are going to have with that is we are going to get into the discussion where the risk manager is going to say, I've got a really good hedging instrument that achieves my risk management objectives, but it may be not the textbook derivative. How much noise are you saying I'm going to have in P&L? Because
that's the key question.
That's my point.
That's a key question where we put that. But the one thing is, to even say that there's noise, would you implicitly that in that we need to measure the perfect?
Yeah, but before we even get to that, they're going to tell you it is perfect.
That's why we're trying to define it. That's why
we're
trying to define it.
We're going to have a debate before we even get on to the consequence.
Martin.
I thought we have this discussion, as Kumar said, what is a benchmark if everything, even it is perfect? What is if risk management was perfectly executed and everything, the target model is achieved, what should be the P&L treatment? And that would be, okay, the derivative should be fair value in OCI, and then, okay, the interest piece recycled back into the P&L, that we have a kind of interest income, interest expense, reflecting really the derivatives using that. That was, I think, that's what the staff want to have the board decided on. But if we could not agree, if that is the accounting treatment, and I choked on the beginning, that then we should stop the project, because I'm really serious about that. If we cannot agree if that is the accounting treatment, we should stop the project.
I don't disagree. I'm just worried that people are going to think perfect means something more perfect than we intend.
But that is a different discussion. What does perfect alignment mean? And if you have not an alignment, what is the P&L consequences of that? But I think that is a different discussion. My understanding was the staff want to achieve today is only...
For example, they might think a perfect derivative is with a risk-free counterparty.
Well, can I ask a question? Because I've done the up-down thing, which generally suggests it's going to be a stupid question. But so just a heads up on this. But I, when I read this question, I was reading it in the context of setting the principle.
Yes,
exactly.
Not in the context of setting the mechanics. And I think a lot of the questions we're getting into are the mechanics. And I accept that the mechanics are where all the complexity is going to come here. But what I think we're trying to say is, are we comfortable with the idea that we override the natural accounting for the derivative and the underlying portfolio in a circumstance where this is perfect in order to give us what essentially would be the target profile accounting? If we're comfortable with that, then to Martin's point, then we have a macro hedging project, because we know. Then we can figure out actually what the mechanic should be. Is okay.
So, following up on Sue's point, it's like fully agree. People will come up with different ideas of what is perfect and everything, and that's why we are trying to define it. It's no different. I don't want to use the term. What we do is very similarly in cash flow hedging today when we look at a particular method of measurement. It's a method of measurement, what we are proposing. And the recycling and the, it's your fault, reclassification, what happens is basically following the mechanics which will achieve what it has to happen. So this is setting out the principle by which it will work, and any deviation from that is something that will be discussed with the board to see what we do with that. And that's the tolerance level, lower of test. What happens when, frankly speaking, the biggest one is prepayments. It's a change in parameter.
But Sue's point about credit risk is another one that may well give rise to...
Yeah, absolutely.
Nick?
Thank you. I hear the concerns about the language, but notwithstanding that, I think without this principle, you can't move ahead and you have to have this benchmark. So I'm aligned with that. Just on the question of credit risk, just for clarification... As far as I understand, we've only discussed credit risk in relation to what qualifies as an asset so far, and we haven't touched counterparty risk, or have we touched counterparty risk?
We haven't touched counterparty risk.
We said it couldn't, credit risk couldn't dominate.
But that was in the context of the asset portfolio.
Yeah.
We have no criteria that if the credit risk dominates the derivative, we've not proposed any criteria that derivative couldn't be put in. We could discuss if we should have that, but we have not proposed that yet.
Put it on the
list. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Quick comment on the perfect alignment issue. Hearing all the discussion, and I do agree with staff, by the way, but maybe just to challenge you to try to really define what's perfect alignment. because we do not define in the whole section. We say that perfect line is achieved by, but we do not define. Maybe defining it associated with DRM would be easier for us to and outsiders to understand what we meant by perfect alignment, because we do not define actually.
Okay.
We do discuss that later in the paper.
Yeah.
Into that field, but I see where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Put the anchor in as a definition.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Do you need a vote?
Yes. Those in favor?
Is this question one?
Question two.
Are they all numbered question one?
13
in favor. One, you're abstaining from this.
The questions are numbered. In the second section, to Amaro's point here, the title of the section is "What is perfect alignment and measurement thereof?" So in paragraphs 21 through 34, the paper discusses what is perfect alignment and proposes a method to measure it. It should come as no surprise that perfect alignment is achieved when the asset profile in conjunction with the designated derivatives equals the target profile. Mathematically rearranged, this means that the perfect derivatives are those that ensure the previous statement is true. As stated in paragraph 24, while the model will not specify what method to use when measuring perfect alignment, entities could compare the designated derivatives with the perfect derivatives as described. If equal, then perfection has been achieved. The staff recognize that in a dynamic environment, the construction of the perfect derivative may be operationally complicated, as it implies the need to add new derivatives as new lending occurs and also remove old derivatives as particular layers of the target profile mature/expire. If an entity were to update its data daily, this would imply adding and removing multiple derivatives daily due to the construction of the perfect derivative. While the need for multiple derivatives is an accurate reflection of risk management, this may result in operational complications. The staff are proposing that the board discuss potential simplifications in a subsequent meeting on the basis of cost versus benefit. As such, question two to the board. Does the board agree that perfect alignment is achieved when the asset profile in conjunction with the designated derivatives equals the target profile? Does the board agree that when measuring alignment, while the model will not specify what method to use, comparing the designated derivatives with the perfect derivatives is one method of measuring the degree of alignment?
Perfect here just means nothing else but 100%, right?
It somewhat is associated with previous discussion. We somewhat discussed it second with together with one.
Yeah.
Anybody against?
Tom, quick question. So in the dynamic, you say it gets harder to measure perfect alignment. And so when we vote, we're presuming that we're going to ultimately stress test our ability to measure.
Yes.
So this is like we're just going to follow along and we're going to try and perfect our measurements as we go. We don't know for certain at this point that we can achieve fully satisfactory measurements.
Okay, I'm jumping ahead. When we come to the operational simplification, Storm, the word simplification implies some amount of sacrifice. Sacrifice compared to what? This perfect situation. But that's how we will see how far we are moving and what will be the misalignment.
But we can always, we'll always deal. One question is, that was my question because there's two things. Will we always know the anchor, which is the perfect alignment? Because you said, when we simplify, we'll measure it against the. But we've no doubt that we can measure that anchor.
Yes. In the simplification, that anchor has to be there.
Okay.
There will be simplifications, but yes, you will be able to track and measure the anchor.
Mary?
As long as we're still in the conversation about perfect alignment, that kind of perfection, I guess I want to think about how we articulate this and lay out our logic rather than any concern about the leading us down the garden path of question two. And the point, you raised it, Ross, when you said because the portfolio changes every day, in theory, perfection could require day by day or even hour by hour changes in terms of what derivatives you are using to achieve perfection. I could understand entirely somebody saying, this is what perfect means, but for the cost, the volume of transactions, especially if it's a transaction-by-transaction basis, I'm only going to step in when the dynamic nature throws me out of this range. But I think there's a difference between saying, this is perfection, and here's the range I'll accept around it, and perfection is anything in that range. And I think what we have to focus on is, this is what perfection is. And, you know, the fact that operationally somebody may say, I'll tolerate pluses or minuses of X, we have to, at least when we're talking about perfect matches, start out by saying, okay, that's imperfection. But then we maybe will think about how you calculate it, whether you have to do it on a minute-by-minute, hour-by-hour, day-by-day basis, or, you know, and whether we will require capture of all of that. But I don't think we should start fuzzing what is perfect, because that's our benchmark. And, you know, it took me a long time to even get a basic understanding of IFRS 9 and IAS 39 hedging about the difference between having to prove, you know, a reasonable prospective expectation of effectiveness from what actually happens. And I bring this up now because the fact that you may expect to fall short of perfection does not mean you are disqualified entirely from the model. It's just trying to set out what your benchmark is. And I think, again, we've got to be very careful in how we communicate these things so people understand what we're talking about holding them to, versus then how we might operationalize it.
So,
staying on my theme of credit risk. So I think I might have misunderstood our previous decisions,
yeah.
And that's because when I look at IFRS 9, I just double-checked,
yep.
It talks about the credit risk effect on both the hedged item and the hedging instrument. So my sort of natural inclination is to think
really?
They matter on both cases. Well, we've spent long enough talking about it. And so I think we need to just be clear on that. But just secondly on that and on the notion of the perfect hedge. So I think that a lot of the focus in the paper, which is fine and right, is on whether or not the sort of cash flows match to achieve the outcomes you're looking for.
Yep.
But when we, at the moment, even when we apply cash flow hedge accounting under 9, we think about the effect on the change in fair value for the hedged item and the derivative. And so implicit in that, you're thinking about the credit risk in the hedged item, even in a cash flow hedge.
Yep.
And that's what we clarified with the whole hypothetical nightmare we had on IFRS 9. But because now we're talking about a model where you're talking about comparing the perfect derivative with the derivative you actually have, I think that means necessarily we will need to talk about what the credit risk assumption should be on your perfect derivative so you know what it is you're comparing with.
Okay.
Because that's different
to
what we have today.
Yeah, that's fair.
Well, because, yeah, without going into, yes, you have to, because it's there. I would argue it's implicitly there in 9. You have to consider it, but
yeah.
We'll make it clarified.
In 9, you have to consider it, but you know, because you're measuring the hedged item.
Yeah.
Here you're measuring it indirectly using the perfect hedge as the thing you're using. So it's slightly different.
Yeah, it's
slightly yeah. Makes it more, but I don't think it's that. We can capture it.
That's
well, we can't be silent on the credit risk.
Exactly.
That's what I'm going to say. Okay. So, can we get a vote? All in favour?
Two.
Question two.
Question two. Question two. Sue, you're against?
14.
All 14.
Which question I was voting on?
I think this is a perfect score, but what does perfect mean?
It means in the absence of credit, Hans, 14. The absence of
you
credit.
You laugh now, Hans, you just wait.
Yeah, if you think this is painful.
Oh, the pain isn't started.
Deferral.
Yeah, that doesn't give you much sympathy.
Section 3. Deferral and reclassification. In paragraphs 36 through 63, the paper discusses the principles and the mechanics of reclassification in the case of perfect alignment. This section proposes two principles. The first, what is the time period over which reclassification should take place? I'm going to do one thing at a time here, sorry.
Help.
What is the time period over which reclassification should take place? The staff believe this principle is important to ensure there is a point in time by which any OCI must be removed from the statement of financial position to avoid the situation of balances being deferred indefinitely. As discussed in paragraphs 30 and 39, the staff think the amounts in OCI should be reclassified over the period where risk is being managed, and that period of time is the time horizon of the target profile based upon tentative decisions to date. This will ensure reclassification takes place over the time covered by risk management. Said differently, there should be nothing left in OCI related to the target profile if it has expired because the risk is no longer present or managed. This concept would extend to the layered nature of the target profile as at the layer level. The staff would highlight paragraph 40, where it is stated that this requirement should have little impact in most instances as the fair value of derivatives pulled to par by maturity, but that it will have more impact in the context of early termination. The second principle focuses on the question of what amount should be reclassified each period. As discussed in paragraph 41, the amount to be reclassified will be driven by the tentative decision to reflect the target profile in a situation of perfect alignment. Said differently, if the entity has perfectly achieved the target profile, then the income statement should reflect that target profile. Therefore, the amount to be reclassified each period is the amount that, in conjunction with the effective interest rate of the asset profile, ensures the income statement reflects the target profile. In the example we've demonstrated, this amount would be readily calculable from the accruals on the designated derivative contracts, accruals being defined as the stated coupon multiplied by the stated notional for the period of time also specified in said contract. These are the mechanics that will result in the financial statements achieving the earlier goal of reflecting the TP in the statement of profit or loss if perfect alignment is achieved. The staff have provided a very long example to help demonstrate these concepts in paragraphs 42 through 57. And in addition, as commented in paragraph 60, the staff have considered whether these proposed mechanics will work with risk management strategies other than stabilization, and the model will provide a faithful representation nonetheless. As such, question three to the board is, does the board agree that the period of time over which reclassification should take place is the time horizon of the target profile? Does the board agree that the amounts to be reclassified each period is the amount that ensures the P&L reflects the target profile in conjunction with the asset profile if perfect alignment is achieved?
I do agree with just one clarification. So if I read question three literally, it talks about reclassifying it over the time horizon of the target profile. But my understanding, and I think it would be good if this is correct, just to make it clear and update, mm-hmm. if we agree on it.
Is it an update? Sorry.
If the board agrees, just to make
of course.
It clear.
No, I just want to.
Is if I was in the situation that's set out in paragraph 32 and the example you've got in chart 5, we don't mean that there would be gains and losses still sitting in OCI for derivative 2 after X4. So because of the other, not just this thing, that not just what we're voting on here, which talks about the sort of, the deferral till the maturity of the time horizon, because you've got the recycling concepts that naturally pulls to par, so that means that these ones would mature, wouldn't have deferrals beyond their maturity dates.
Yep.
So there's sort of two things going on that affect the timing of recycling.
Exactly.
Very critically, just to clarify again, here the instruments will pull to par, so it will come to zero by that. But what ensures, and this is where the other thing, why the target profile becomes very important, is that as with every kind of hedging relationship, we recycle over the time horizon of the hedged item. It will work with all instances, even with options, which doesn't pull to par. But it works, as you pointed out, for two reasons, not just because it's got to be zero. And this is another quotable quote from the last time when I was working on this project, is this is a rolling debit that gathers no loss. This is what gets it out to zero, is the recycling. But it's not just pulling it to zero. It's in conjunction with what we are targeting in P&L that it works, and the mechanics comes in and the accrual just pulls out and it works. So we will make that clear. Yes, you cannot. But it has to be over the target profile, so because of a couple of things, you can have forward starting swaps and other things which work differently. So that's where the mechanics pulls it, but we will clarify that.
But it will work so that you don't have amounts hanging up in OCI for derivatives that have already matured.
No, it cannot be.
As far as
I agree with the recommendation. I just had a question. When you refer to the criteria in paragraph 61, that you would propose qualifying criteria, is that something that you intend to do in this phase or in the latter phase?
Sorry, I 61
discusses
qualifying criteria.
Qualifying criteria for risk management strategy.
Yeah, we'll discuss that in this phase.
So it is in this phase.
After performance.
After performance, but this phase.
Okay.
Can I just explain? Go ahead, Françoise. Coming in paragraph 60, as we said, because the objective of the model is not to preclude risk management strategies, but to reflect it, there could be certain strategies that whatever we decide on performance will not be able to stop, like trading strategies and other things. I'm not saying which ones those are and what the leverage strategies are, but it's only after we have got an idea of performance we need to come back to you and say that, are you happy? Because a model will show those strategies, and maybe that's not what the information we want to get. I'll give you a classic example. It's been come up. So we have said you allocate it in time buckets. Can you have a negative position in a time bucket or a short position? It's very easy to do that. The model will pick it up, and so will the performance pick it up accordingly, but is that risk management to stabilize? So those are the things we need to cover, but only after we have done performance, because it will be something that the performance will pick up.
And have you thought of having criteria for risk management strategies so that in fact, instead of having your perfect alignment, you would have the effectiveness of the risk management strategy being the anchor?
I would say that's what we are trying to do even with this alignment. It's another way of looking at it. If you try and measure it, your risk management strategy is to come to your target profile. What do you do to achieve it is what the derivativist measurement is trying to capture.
Yeah, but I feel that there might be a difference nevertheless, because I would expect a bank to measure any ineffectiveness in their risk management strategies, whereas I'm not sure that they measure perfect alignment. So, given the fact that we're not talking about a measurement issue on the balance sheet, we're just looking at when things impact P&L.
That's not just.
Well, it's.
That's a big issue that will come up for some of us. I could say that.
It's an important issue. I'm not saying that it's not important, but. I think what we aim at is reflecting the effect that the risk management strategy has. When I say I don't know enough to form a view whether perfect alignment is the appropriate anchor, it's because I had in mind that eventually the qualification of a risk management strategy would be the basis to accept its effects as long as it is perfectly effective.
I think
it's not the same thing, slightly different.
We are not. We will talk about risk management strategies, not which are allowable. I think we are not here to say what you can do, because you can keep positions open if that's the risk you want to play, and the model should pick that up.
Okay.
That's what this method was. The other thing also, when we said we were very careful, we said this is one of the methods. Like in existing thing, we don't say this is the only way. When we do outreach, if people say that we have a different way which achieves the same result, happy to consider it. I can't think of something very easily which would be coming. There are a number of ways, but you will end up measuring something and tracking something. You will end up doing
it. But that may not be that anchor.
It could be a different, but let's see what it is. As long as it comes to the objective, what you're trying to get to, the target profile in P&L, tell me how you do it. Even in current hedging, we don't say that the hypo or one method is the only method we can use.
Mary?
Three things. One is, confirm this, but I just want to flag it for others. Paragraph 51, chart 12, when you talk about there being zero left, I was initially going, how could they be saying that there's zero left if you've just shown a cumulative net effect of 295?
Yep.
And it's the assumption in here that I think would be helpful to spell out in future, that this 295 is getting settled by debit cash credit derivative because of the payment, the periodic payments on the derivative, the cash settlement. So that's what we mean by the accrual.
Yep.
Okay. The second thing is again, it's how we express things, that you explain in here how you tested this model against a number of different strategies and proved that it worked. I think I would phrase it as the testing we did not identify, I hate using lots of negatives, but did not identify any circumstances in which it wouldn't work, because you can't really prove with examples that something always works. But it reminds us also to think about asking questions when we consult about, you know, are there scenarios for which it didn't work? And the third is you give an example of what if your risk management strategy is not to stabilize net interest income, net interest margin, but rather it is to, for example, have your NIM mirror 1 month LIBOR. And that feels like it's starting to ask the question that I think Jingjiao asked at the beginning about, are we doing this only for net interest margin, or are we doing it more broadly? I think, you know, and as you said, right now we're only looking at net interest margin. It isn't what type of entity you are, but it's this activity. I had thought that from what we've done, everything has to be converted into a target profile. And I, you know, when I look at it, I can say, okay, if you have that 1 month LIBOR, you know, mirror as your strategy, yep, then your target profile is 1 month
exactly
variable.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's still, you're still converting it into it. And I don't want to suggest that you can accommodate all different types of strategies that may look and sound and feel much more like trading. But I think what we're saying, at least in phase one, is we're only looking at, and I don't know if it's stabilizing, it's making us think about whether our characterization of stabilizing is right, but it's managing
interest
net
rate,
interest income.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, management of interest rate risk, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll try and work with, might be tricky, I'll catch you on some of the articulation,
yeah,
but that's exactly what we are trying to do.
It suddenly sounded like it was mushrooming into much more when I then realized that you, at least the example you gave, is something you can convert back into what we've been talking about, a target profile.
Yeah, absolutely.
Gary.
Thank you. The question on cost to comply with this thing. And this morning we had a discussion about working cost-benefit analysis throughout projects, and so it was sort of timely. And by the way, I actually do agree with with question three. But now I start thinking about how to do this thing, you know, and as you know, we've discussed, I mean, former life, I used to do this stuff for foreign currency denominated purchases of inventory. It wasn't all that hard to line up, you know, your procurement with your foreign currency derivatives. But I was doing, the time horizon was a month, not a day or an hour, as we might be talking here in some cases. And it all quickly resolved itself through a variance to cost of inventory. And so much easier in that sense, but it wasn't hard to actually line up the monthly, you know, exposure and the derivatives. But now thinking in the center, money center bank or global banking, is in order to zero out OCI, you have to track each layer.
Yes.
So the question becomes, how many layers are you talking? Your examples here, one nice round years that begins on January 1st. What's your outreach telling you we're likely to have to do? And again, the less precise you are, the greater your opportunity for ineffectiveness is, whether it's just ineffective or doesn't naturally zero out. I guess it could be looked at in both ways. But again, think of the cost to comply. Any sense of what this is? Is this what banks already do, and there really is no incremental cost?
Can I jump in on that? I mean, I think when we talk about cost to comply and cost benefits, we do have to compare this to IAS 39 and IFRS 9. And so what are the existing mechanisms today versus what we're proposing in this model? I think if we try to compare it to, can we make the accounting model for a very complicated business the most simple thing in the world? I'm not sure that that's really where we're going with this. But nonetheless, I think we have to make sure that we are considering the cost to implement, the cost to comply, but make sure we get the right benchmark in that comparison. Set it up that way.
Coming to this, Gary, yes, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's a different layer that you set up, and if you're originating every day, you'll have 240 layers in a year, average 5 years. So that's the next thing. We need to think how we come back to the board, but that is the key next discussion. How do we simplify it? And if this is the benchmark which I've set myself, the simplification comes at a cost. And how far is the board willing to go, and what is the cost?
I don't know, because we could just leave it at this and just say let practice establish itself, or regulatory practice establish itself. But I suspect that we're not going to get out of the room if we tried that. We're going to have to give us some guidance. And it gets down to, I think, ineffectiveness or the ability to systematically and rationally reclass what's an OCI out on a timely basis.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
It's not going to be a neat 365-day buckets like here. Is it 30 days? Is it daily? I don't know. You know.
Exactly. So if I just take an average of, let's say, I originate once a month, 5 years, and I do this weekly, just to count the number of times. So that's what the idea is, to bring back on the operational side, if we set the target. And so that the other thing is why we were doing this as the benchmark, is how far of a simplification do you give? Because anything you simplify comes at a cost. It's in the measurement of this, in the tracking. And I, coming from the experience of last time, which is macro fair value hedging, Gary, is that it causes the same problem with the buckets. You end up with spreadsheets with 3,000 lines of amortization patterns, which becomes high risk. The other thing also we will come back and saying, let's discuss, when we started this, we also showed you a reconciliation which banks do to make sure that this thing is working. And as you said, when you were doing it even on a monthly, it's not without tracking, because then you don't know how well you have achieved.
Monthly might be fine, but you also might have 15 different portfolios within the bank that you're tracking. They get their own, you know, risk management profiles and stuff, and you know, maybe a month is close enough. With absent some macro devaluation or some crisis, you know.
And
I don't know, but I think we can't be silent on it, because if this is the concept, well, then you're expected to get as close to the concept operationally as you can, you know.
John, thank you. Just a clarification. On the maybe the, if you see the paragraph 52 and chart 12, the Mary has many comments on this chart 12 on paragraph 52. Just could you explain what these numbers of changes in fair value excluding accrual? So 2001-7 and 2002-40.
So
it becomes, the cumulative becomes zero, but the numbers are in the between their first and what these numbers, is this number has some kind of information content?
Well, I'll explain how the numbers are derived, and then I can explain to you what that number represents. But the numbers on the far right, the accrual, as mentioned somewhere in the paper, that's taking the stated notional of the contracts times their stated coupons, and so that's a very easily calculatable figure. The change in fair value in the first column, I've just made that up. And so then the change in fair value excluding accrual is just subtraction at that point. So that's where the numbers come from.
Yeah.
But the change in fair value excluding accrual represents kind of the change in fair value of all future cash flows. I mean, all cash flows that have yet to be settled or accrued. And that's what it actually represents.
But the thing, you know, it's quite difficult to understand what these figures, numbers mean is, for example, 2002,
yep.
There's no fair value change in derivatives, zero. But you have to make some kind of accrual interest income to make the 80 of target profile. So you need 40. So that's accrual.
That's not made up. That's exactly what will come from the contractual terms of the swap.
Yeah, sure. They will make our goal.
Interest payment.
Yeah, but I understand. The mechanics are, I understand. But
No. This is contractual, Changu. There will be a cash flow that happens of 40.
This goes back to Mary's comment.
It's the column that says, look at the column that says accrual. And I can't remember what this example is, but it is the notional amount of the derivative times whatever the swap is. If it's fixed, you know, for floating, it's taking that difference, multiplying it by the notional. So these guys, showing their biases, are calling it the interest rate, the interest on the derivative. It isn't really interest, but it's...
Nine also calls it that, the accrual. The terms we used are from nine.
Yeah, but it's the Come on, I'm teasing you. it's the, what is it, generally quarterly payment? Sometimes it's monthly, sometimes it's quarterly, on a derivative that settles up for the difference in the two rates times the notional equals the amount that you get paid that period. And the idea is that that payment would be treated as if it were an interest payment and included in net interest.
Yeah.
But if we cite that this aspect of this model, it's understandable. But if we see we are using a kind of base of cash flow hedging mechanic, so from the perspective of that point, if there's no fair value change in your derivatives,
yeah,
you do exactly this.
Yeah, so if you have, there's no fair value, in that example, if there's no fair value change in the derivative,
right,
but I'm moving a period forward in time,
yes,
the model is proposing that there would be an amount reclassified from OCI to the income statement approximating the interest accrual for that time period.
But in a general, in a case of the IFRS 9 cash flow hedging accounting, we just have one situation account of the accumulated change, right?
Sorry.
We have a perfect effective.
In case of you had a 1:1 cash flow hedge, this is exactly what the entry would happen, Chengu.
Mm-hmm. Okay, can I see if we support the staff's view? Preliminary view?
Yeah. 14. Yeah.
And we'll make the amendments on the update about the profile as
and we will also update voting if everybody's okay from perfect to benchmark. I think that's a better from perfect to benchmark in the update.
Benchmark derivatives.
Yeah.
Okay. Testing. I'm going to ask questions 4 and 5 together because I think that makes sense. But in paragraph 64 through 73, the staff explain that perfect alignment will not always be achieved, and therefore testing may be required to demonstrate the extent to which alignment has been achieved, and provide evidence that the cash flows are indeed linked. This section addresses the need for a prospective test only as a precondition for the application of the model. The questions on the prospective test are not meant to imply that if an entity successfully passes this test, then it does not need to measure misalignment. More specifically, if an entity achieves 92% on the prospective test, this paper and thus the questions to the board do not address how the 8% misalignment should be communicated to users of financial reporting. How the model will communicate this information will be discussed when the board discusses imperfect alignment. The staff are focusing on the prospective test in this paper because, as mentioned in paragraph 65, discussing the need for a retrospective test could be inefficient and effective without first understanding the measurement implications of misalignment. As such, the staff plan to discuss the potential need for a retrospective test when the board discusses imperfect alignment. Similar to IFRS 9, the staff are proposing that the test focus on establishing an economic relationship between the items designated in the model. In paragraph 70, the staff discuss why the term economic relationship in this context would be different in IFRS 9 or IS 39, sorry, IFRS 9, and that the objective of the DRM model is not offset, but alignment, and therefore testing should focus on alignment. The consequences of failing the test are discussed in paragraph 72, but to summarize, failing would constitute a discontinuation event of the model. Regarding frequency of testing, the staff are proposing that, given the dynamic nature of portfolios, testing should be completed on an ongoing basis, and this is discussed in paragraph 75 through 77. The staff are not proposing a bright line test for the reasons listed in paragraph 73, which are again consistent with the rationale within IFRS 9. As such, questions 4 and 5 to the board are, does the board agree that entities must demonstrate the existence of an economic relationship to apply the model? If they cannot demonstrate such, the model should be discontinued prospectively. Does the board agree that the test should not be a bright line test, but should be completed on an ongoing basis, given the dynamic nature of portfolios?
Mary?
Comment that goes back more to question 4, the no bright line test, but even more specifically to paragraph 71 in the statement that the model should not specify a specific method to demonstrate the existence of an economic relationship. When I looked at that and when I said originally in paragraph 24 where I was thinking about it more as a for measuring alignment, you know, paragraph 24 said the model should not specify a method for measuring alignment. And that set off some alarm bells for me. I can see that, I'm going to draw from somewhere else. IFRS 2, we decided in the standard of share-based payment not to specify whether, you know, you had to use Black-Scholes or binomial or Monte Carlo simulation or, for measuring things. But we did, you know, we do specify what it is you are trying to measure, you know, in which case it was the fair value on fair value is IFRS 2 divided on X day. Yep. And the language in 24 and 71, maybe because it's preliminary stages, is loose enough. It almost sends the signal of you get to define, you know, what alignment is. And I think we have to be able to spell out what is alignment. And that may go back to it's by saying what the, you know, previous, the benchmark, you know, formerly known as perfection, yep. Is. But we do, I think we do need to specify what it is that you're measuring, even if we ultimately decide we're not going to specify a methodology for it. And the language was just loose enough, it made it sound like it might be a lot more open than I would be comfortable with, because I think we could make all the discipline in the world about later on how you report imperfection.
Yep.
But if we leave it up to you to define what constitutes perfection, that's built on sand.
Agreed. I think it comes back to Amaro's point also that we need to define what is that alignment and what when it actually is. And what you're talking about, maybe in loose terms, what is the objective I'm trying to measure, achieve through that measurement?
Okay.
Yeah, we'll be careful.
Because 71 is maybe a bit more specific. 24 seemed very broad. We should not specify a method for measuring alignment.
Amaro?
I think I was about to make the same comment as Kumar did. It's apparently very loose the way we are describing here, but I think what we have to have behind our heads is that these are actually directly associated with the DRM strategy. It's not that it's no pieces that you are bringing together and make up your the result, your performance. This is aligned with that. And also, because we are not really into the qualitative aspects, this is apparently loose enough. So just bear in mind that we are actually talking about DRM strategy that is documented, authorized,
yeah.
Approved at the right level, yeah. Monitored, and blah, 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 all the documentation. And this is to get to the accounting model, we are going to the qualitative yet. Can be very loose, high level, can be more detailed. We didn't discuss that yet.
No, we will set out the objectives. It comes back to your same comment, Maru, very clearly define. If you're going to measure to something, that has to be very clearly set, as Mary was saying, one of the words.
We just exemplified so far.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Almost same point. I was trying to understand the difference between micro hedge and the macro hedge. And in your paragraph 70, you said, unlike in the case of micro hedge, it's kind of simple offsetting idea, but the alignment is different.
Yes.
But you talked about economic relationship.
Yep.
But at the same time, you cited some of the paragraphs of IFRS 9. So my question may be a silly question, but are you saying that idea of economic relation is almost same with IFRS 9, but the methodology is different? Is that what you are saying? Or idea of economic relationship is quite different from IFRS 9, which is true?
It's different. The principle is what we are going for. There's a relationship. When IFRS 9 says that's an economic relationship exists when there's an offset. But for us, the relationship exists when there's not an offset, but you get them aligned.
Alignment.
So it's reverse of what we are saying.
Yeah.
But the concept is the relationship.
The signs are different.
We'll measure it. In IFRS 9, your derivative and your hedging instrument must move in opposite direction. Here
the
it must move in the same direction.
Ah, I see. Directions. But the outcome of economic relationship idea is
the idea is, yes,
same.
Yeah.
Similar to what we are saying.
Yeah. Mm.
What is the relationship?
That confused me.
Yeah.
Because it's the opposite, but the underlying idea is same.
Yeah. So
I agree with not having a sort of bright line and with the idea of looking at the sort of nature of the relationship, if you like. But I think, and I don't have the answer, but I feel like we need to do a little bit more. Because if I look at IFRS 9, in a contrast, I know that's not what we're aiming for, but just for purposes of illustration. So we use in paragraph 70 this idea of better aligned.
Yep.
And if I look at IFRS 9, first of all, there's a difference because we're talking about offset, which is different to what we're doing here. But in IFRS 9, we talk about the fact that there needs to be, as you've quoted here, values generally move in the opposite direction. But in 9, we go on and say more. So we certainly took away the 80-125 test, but we also said that there must be an expectation that the value of the items will systematically change in response to movements, either in the same underlying or something very similar.
Yep.
And so I think if you came to me with a hedging relationship, and it's always scary with a live standard, but if you came to me and said, okay, I've got a relationship of offset, and for every movement of 100 in my hedged item, I'm going to have a movement of 30 in the opposite direction with my hedging instrument,
yep.
I'd probably say, well, good luck. That's not a systematic offset of the nature that we had in place. So even though we didn't set in place the 80-125 type bright line, we expected it to be, you know,
closer.
A closest offset.
Yep.
If I can use that untechnical term.
Yeah.
Whereas if I look at here just saying better aligned, so say I had a situation where my natural gap between my assets and my liabilities would mean I was exposed to rate risk between years 1 and 5, I might enter into a derivative that would mean I've closed the gap. So now I've got only a gap between years 2 and 5. It's better aligned, but is that aligned enough? Is that what we mean? And so I think better's too loose, and the concept of economic relationship needs, for me, I think, to be built up to express a bit more closely this idea that we're trying to get to closer to your target profile. Then there's some notion of how close you get to that, and I don't know how to express that, but I think 9 is trying to express that, and we can't copy it directly because it's an offset notion, but I think personally we need to achieve something more like.
Martin?
Yeah, a little bit like Suhrmann. I think we really don't need these bright lines, but we need a little bit more than this economic relationship, because I think we allow quite a lot of kind of strategies companies can do with this target profile, and then only to say, okay, we have to demonstrate an economic relationship is too loosey, to change really kind of fair value accounting to this kind of model. I cannot exactly say what we need more, but I have a bad feeling that is not sufficient.
We will work on that.
And we need really kind of what Sue said, maybe aligning more kind of closing gaps or in the interest, I don't know, this kind of things. I think we need a little bit more. Otherwise, I feel not comfortable to, especially why we also allowing a lot of strategies than as a target profile, right?
There's flexibility there. Can I come in?
What I'm saying, I'd be surprised if any risk manager would object, because I think it's what they're trying to achieve. But I think we need to be careful that we're describing it in a way that...
Yeah. Two things. Absolutely, I'm not saying otherwise or anything. We will certainly work on that. We need to, even this wording with this, so if we go out, the question comes out 88% and 78%, what happens? I'm not trying to answer that, but we need to give people. But I would just like to remind people of another thing. As of 9 in 9, under IFRS 9, any ineffectiveness is always in P&L. We are not there yet. We haven't, and there will be relaxations here, or possible, depending upon what the board decides. So I think we will also have to keep that in mind, because only we are saying it's a qualifying criteria, Martin, what you get in, yeah, given the simplification. Okay, we will draft something, but I think we will also bring back some words to you when we come back to you after things on retrospective on this one. Yeah. Fair?
Yeah. Okay. Given this huge concession, can we
get a vote? Yeah.
Support the staff's recommendation.
So
4 and 5.
4 and 5.
But what's the recommendation? I'm not going to just economic relationship defined.
Yeah, I think we're being asked to come back with something.
We will come back with something on that. That the methodology works, but not any the economic relationship. What we will say in the update, and what I'm asking people to vote on, is that
not a bright line.
Not a bright line. It'll be it is an, not an offset concept like in 39. It's an alignment concept, which I'm asking, which we will clarify further when we come to the retrospective test. Is that fair, sir?
With frequency on an ongoing basis.
Yeah. All in favour? Are you okay with question five?
I voted on both, so
okay.
Count your blessings and go on.
I am, Hans, I really am. Okay, go on.
Kumar, can I just make a suggestion keeping track of these points? So, you know, you started keeping a running summary of decisions made in Agenda Paper 4A. It might be helpful to start accumulating within that the points that we're going to have to go back and, you know, bring better definition, consider further, et cetera. It's a bit like having to publicly expose your to-do list, but it would be useful for people to understand where we think we need to build out more on these points where you've got basic agreement at a high level.
Okay. So on the final question here, discontinuation. Paragraphs 78 through the end of the paper discussed discontinuation and the impact on the accounting model from a voluntary discontinuation. As stated in the paper, while discontinuation may be rare, given risk management will likely continue, the model must contemplate such an event, otherwise it would be incomplete. If the model was discontinued voluntarily, and the method by which is described in the paper, there are two ideas of how that could happen, there will most likely be an amount deferred in OSS and other comprehensive income at the time of discontinuation. It follows logically from earlier discussions regarding the need for deferral and reclassification to faithfully reflect the activity in financial reporting. This amount also must be reclassified to the statement of profit or loss. An entity deciding to terminate the model does not alter that conclusion. As such, the staff are proposing that if the cash flows of those items designated in the model will occur, then the amounts deferred in OCI should be reclassified as described earlier. To do otherwise would imply a change in the pattern of reclassification, which, given the voluntary nature of the discontinuation, is considered inappropriate in the eyes of the staff and could also result in the balance being deferred past the time horizon of risk management. As stated in the paper, the time horizon in question is the one immediately prior to discontinuation, not the one after a change in risk management strategy. Furthermore, if the cash flows are not going to occur, then all balances deferred should be reclassified immediately to P&L, similar to the requirements within IFRS 9. As such, question six to the board is, does the board agree that when an entity chooses to discontinue, but the cash flows are still expected to occur, the amounts deferred should be reclassified over the life of the target profile such that the statement of profit or loss reflects the target profile consistent with the principles previously discussed?
Amaro.
Just a clarification. When I read this, how do I understand the objective? If we go back to the objective of the accounting model itself, is to reflect the strategy, DRM strategy. And now that I decide to discontinue the accounting model, why or how would I justify keeping the mechanics up to the moment where I still have some leftovers? So I found a little bit tricky. How do I understand the reasoning? I think we need to be very clear why.
You want to keep something in OCI after I have stopped the model?
No, I don't want to. I believe the mechanics that you are proposing make sense to better reflect the origin of the classification. I just think we have to think very clearly how to justify this once the entity decides to end the DRM accounting. If the objective is still to reflect the strategy, the DRM strategy. So I felt...
No, fair point.
Yeah.
The only thing I would say is that you can't continue it if you don't have your asset profile and your liability profile. Yeah. That's the only time where you have to reflect everything. But if your asset profile and liability profile exists, and you have managed it up to a point, going forward, that management up to that point, which is deferred in OCI, should be reflected accordingly.
Yeah.
That's the justification, I would say, why you don't flush everything as of today in hedge accounting. Because otherwise, if you stop it for some reason, let's say the business closing, but your assets and everything, let's say your trading derivative books goes away due to some reason. But you have been successful. And remember, what we have in OCI, Amaro, is the clean value for future. as long as all those future cash flows are expected to occur, I think that should be recycled over that period.
No, I understand the reason. Fair enough. The trick is that we are developing a model to reflect the strategy. If the strategy doesn't exist anymore, how come it's still the accounting captures that?
Yeah.
Martin?
Yeah, I'm only struggling with my... At the date of when a company is discontinuing this model, and if the cash flows are still expected, I agree. But what is maybe if they have a risk management strategy for 5 years and 1 year later after they have done, the cash flows are not in place, then they still reconcile it over the original term. And is that appropriate? That is, do we need something, that we still we still do the reclassification if the cash flows are still in place, but not only...
That's what we mean.
That exactly. is what you mean, because exactly. I have read it only as a date and transition.
If your cash flows are no longer going to... Let's say you've sold off your assets, you've sold off your liabilities, then why will you have any...
Okay, then I have misread it. And
sorry, apologies, but that's not what we're saying.
I think you explained it that when you talked to me, I think it was clearer than in the paper.
Because you said at the date of termination. That is maybe what was
talking about the reverse. I'm looking at the reverse situation where you continue. If you don't have any of your future cash flows, then it immediately recycles.
Then we are fine,
Okay, can we...
Amaro, are you okay?
I'm okay.
How we put it.
How we communicate
sure we
that.
Okay. All in favor?
Final. Good. Perfect score, okay. We take a break till 10-2?